Bindu Bajgan versus Devendra Bajgan. And now the docket, of course, as I announced earlier, reflects that the appellant had waived oral argument, but of course that's incorrect. We granted the appellant's motion for oral argument, so we'll be glad to hear from the appellant in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Saquita Banks, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Bindu Bajgan. I want to first thank the court for allowing me to have the opportunity to give some more argument today. This case involves two Nepalese citizens who are residents of Virginia.
This is International Day in the Court of Appeals, isn't it?
It happens to be, Your Honor. Appellee initiated a divorce proceeding in the Fairfax Circuit Court in April 20th of 2011. Appellant filed an answer and a cross-complaint on May 13th of 2011. But then appellant, my client, initiated a divorce proceeding in her home country of Nepal and also requested a property distribution proceeding in Nepal to divide property that was located in Nepal on August 30th. She was subsequently awarded PL relief in the Virginia proceedings. Nepal then issues a divorce, but appellant appealed the divorce, which served to cancel the divorce action under Nepalese law. Appellant proceeded, however, with her property distribution case in Nepal. The Fairfax Circuit Court proceedings were stayed pending the outcome of the Nepal property distribution proceeding. Now, during this time period, Nepal requested property lists from both the appellant and the appellee of all the property.
Did your client object to that stay?
She did not, Your Honor. And as a result, on May 7th of 2013, the Nepal court issued a property distribution decision. However, we contend that that property distribution decision, which was should have required the distribution of property located in Nepal owned by the parties, it failed to award the...
Well, counsel, let me interrupt you and see if we can kind of simplify this a little bit.
Sure.
Your client filed for divorce in Nepal. The divorce was never finalized in Nepal, but she also asked for equitable distribution, but she asked for them to distribute the marital property there, which they proceeded to do. Without objection, companion proceedings in Virginia were stayed pending the outcome of the actions of the Nepal court. When the matter came back before the circuit court, I'm looking at the record and where the circuit court judge found as a fact that because she had sought the relief and had received notice that there were no due process implications. And then he also made an finding that I haven't heard since my days taking equity in law school about the doctrine of unclean hands, finding that she did not have unclean hands in all of this. So, I mean, given this background, you now complain to us that the trial court erred in all of this. And before we even get to the merits of it, I'm looking at a final order that only says seen and objected to on the grounds that the decree incorporates the October 2nd, 2013 order, which was issued contrary to law. That's the only stated objection in the record. So I guess I'm trying to understand how this entire appeal isn't basically waived or defaulted because of the nature of the only objection that was made here. So help us with that.
I understand, Your Honor. Regarding the preservation of our issues on appeal, I understand that Rule 5A, 18 of the rules of the Supreme Court require us to make a timely and specific objection at the time of the ruling. However, the court has held in Lee versus Lee that appellant may satisfy this rule in multiple ways. And also the Virginia Supreme Court has held in Code Section 8.01-384 that their interpretation of the Virginia Supreme Court Rule 5A 18 under Helms v. Mansfield helps them guide how that is also met. And 8.01-384 provides in part that arguments made at trial via written pleadings, memorandums, recitals of objections, and in the final order, oral argument reduced to a transcript, or agreed written statements of fact shall, unless expressly withdrawn or waived, be deemed preserved therein for assertion on appeal. And I would just argue, Your Honor, that prior to us having the August 15th hearing,
on appendix page, sorry to interrupt, but appendix page 560 to 570, you filed a memorandum of points of authority with the trial court, making substantially the same arguments to the trial judge that
Correct.
You're making to us on appeal.
Correct. And I also, at the August 15th hearing itself, in the very opening of the case, went into a very detailed explanation of our reasons for the challenging the decision, the lack of comedy in the case, therefore arguing to the trial court that comedy should not be granted. And also, we believe throughout the hearing transcript, our expert provided testimony also supporting the legal arguments set forth during the hearing. So we believe that the record itself demonstrates that the trial court was fully aware of our assignments of errors and arguments, so that they were afforded with the opportunity to rule intelligently on the issues as required by West v. Commonwealth.
Can I ask you on a related issue? As you know, there was an interlocutory order that you appealed to this court. And that order, that decision came up and then was dismissed with prejudice earlier this year.
It was dismissed without prejudice, Your Honor.
Does it specifically say without prejudice?
It does.
Okay.
Because appellee's counsel wanted it with prejudice.
Okay.
And it said it was just dismissed.
Dismissed without prejudice.
Well, it doesn't say without prejudice.
It just said dismissed. It was dismissed.
It doesn't say
but
with
it doesn't
or
say
without.
With or without. That's correct. And so
If it dealt with the same, if the issues on appeal to us through that order are essentially the issues that you're appealing today, again, from the final order, right? Those are essentially the same issues that are being brought up to us. Why would the fact that if it was dismissed before not, and if it doesn't say that it was dismissed without prejudice, not mean that it was actually dismissed with prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that when I filed the notice of appeal initially, that was all that was filed. Immediately after that, I notified appellee's counsel and said, we're not going forward on this appeal. I'm going to be withdrawing it. And there were no assignments of errors. We never filed an appellate brief. I contacted the Court of Appeals immediately and said, we're not going forward.
Would this court have jurisdiction to adjudicate equitable distribution issues without entry of the final order of divorce? Can you take an interlocutory appeal on the ED issues prior to entry of the final decree of divorce?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and that's why I decided that it would be best to wait until after we receive the final order of divorce.
Let me follow up on that. Assuming we get to the merits of all of this, essentially what reading between the lines here, what I gather has occurred is everybody, there's no dispute that the parties submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of Nepal initially. For whatever reason, a determination was made, and apparently under Nepal law or Nepalese law, if you secure a divorce, you don't get spousal support. Excuse me, if the property is distributed, you don't get spousal support.
That's correct.
Which, of course, is an American law. Now, whether the parties were aware of that or not, the point is that they did submit themselves to the laws of Nepal. Now, I guess at some point, realizing that there's an attempt made to secure a divorce in one place and a property, equitable distribution of the property in another nation, and the question is really for the trial court and for us is to what the trial court, for the reasons enumerated, extended comedy to the foreign order. finding specifically that there was notice, so the, at least procedural due process was satisfied, and that based on the circumstances surrounding all of these various things that we've talked about, that your client has unclean hands, which is an equitable concept that we've merged law and equity, but and I'm not sure how that all meshes together, but making that factual finding certainly doesn't put your client in the best possible legal position in terms of seeking equitable relief concerning the equitable distribution of the property. So given, I guess, given all of that, in order to getting to the merits of it, how do we say the trial, where did the trial court err as a matter of law? We're bound by the factual findings if there's evidence to support them. So where is the error of law here given that?
Your Honor, I would argue that the error of law was that the Nepal court itself and in the Supreme Court decision in Pandy versus Pandy says stated that they don't have jurisdiction to distribute U.S. held property, which they did.
But we can't attack that. I mean, that's the highest court of Nepal certainly doesn't report to us. And so we have an order that your client sought or participated in getting. And the only question for American courts, it seems to me, since we can't collaterally attack that or we can't permit a collateral attack on that order, is whether or not to enforce it.
Correct.
And so whether, in other words, whether to extend comity to it, because.
And I believe just the principles of comity themselves would dictate that we should not, that the trial court should not have granted comity to this decree for the simple fact that Nepal had no jurisdiction to divide the property that they divided. There is no reciprocity between the United States and Nepal, which is also a basis that the U.S. courts have held.
Do we even get to comity if your client agreed, stipulated, that when they came back to Fairfax, whatever Nepal had resolved would be foreclosed from relitigation in Fairfax?
And that's an interesting point, Your Honor. And the way that I read that agreement, I read that agreement to say for those issues that Nepal has decided on. However, there were issues and marital issues that were never decided, property that was never decided on by the Nepal courts. And under that
other
agreement.
Other than the pension, what else?
Cars, there were bank accounts. Apelli has a list of items.
So if there's anything that's not on that list, that would still have to be apportioned.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Why doesn't our decision in Miller versus Jenkins resolve this? Miller versus Jenkins is the same-sex couple that they went to Vermont to get a divorce, agreed to let Vermont decide the matter, one of the parties didn't like the result, sought a divorce in Virginia, attempting to collaterally attack Vermont's order because Virginia does not, or at least at that time, did not recognize same-sex marriages. And we held in that case that no collateral attack under the both the statute and international, or not international, but that's a full faith and credit, not a comedy situation. But under the full faith and credit clause, by submitting themselves to the jurisdiction of the foreign court, we had to give full faith and credit to that under the Constitution. Now, the doctrine of comedy is not quite as draconian as the full faith and credit clause, but given that the parties submitted themselves to the jurisdiction, sort of implicitly agreed to accept whatever happened, and now seek to complain about it in a court that does not have appellate jurisdiction over what happened in a foreign country, you know, why isn't this the same situation, analytically at least, as the Miller-Jenkins situation?
Your Honor, I would say that a couple of things are different. One, in Nepal, my client had an inheritance issue that's under the Nepal law at being a woman, that she was allowed to inherit property not from her own family, but as our expert testified in the record, she could only inherit from her husband's family. There was no other way for her to get the distribution of that property other than to file in Nepal. She didn't go over there in Nepal to try to get a better decision than she would have gotten here in Virginia. And in fact, throughout all of the proceedings, she continuously stated to the Nepal courts. The Virginia courts are handling the Virginia property. I'm just trying to get the distribution of the property that is inherited, that I have inherited by marriage. And that's what she was trying to get to. And I think that distinguishes it a little bit, as it's a cultural difference. And also that there was, Virginia would have had no way to distribute that property, only Nepal could have. And that is why she sought to take action there. She was not trying to do it in order to, or did not have unclean hands. That was not her intention when she went over there and actually filed the divorce proceedings either. She was honestly under the impression that she thought, because I was married under the laws of Nepal, I have to be divorced under the laws of Nepal. And when she found out that that was not in fact the case is when she rescinded that application.
If you want to do your rebuttal, you can, well, actually, you're almost out of time. I'll give you another minute in rebuttal.
Thank you.
I've been doing that all along.
Good morning, or I guess now good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm actually Colleen Sweeney, not Amanda DeFedia. They asked me to point that out to you.
Colleen Sweeney?
Colleen Sweeney. One thing I need to initially correct is something factual. I represent the appellee in this case, the husband, and he did not agree to the jurisdiction in Nepal. In fact, in the final property order, the court acknowledges that he fought that the entire time. The proceedings began in Fairfax. He wanted the proceedings to end in Fairfax. And on page 771 and 772 of the appendix, the court in Nepal notes that. I will note that I don't believe this is procedurally properly before the court, as the court had noted. One, she did appeal the order, the October 2nd order, and although her argument is she quickly determined that she didn't want to pursue that, what she did is she waited until February. She appealed in October. She waited until February to withdraw that appeal, or at that time she notified the court.
Our jurisdiction? I mean, I'd always assume in these divorce, I mean, there's certain things that by statute, like an injunction, you can take that up prior to resolution of the case. I'd always assume in divorce cases, everything goes up at one time. We don't get this piecemeal appeal. So what authority would we have had to hear that appeal?
I think it's very narrow, Your Honor. And I would agree that in most divorce cases, because what you're ultimately asking for is a divorce, then until the divorce is granted, you can't appeal. I would agree with that in most cases. But what I think the case law really looks at is, you know, what's left to do. And the court struck barred her prayers for relief in this case. So all that she could do was actually find divorce. But it tied the trial court's hands at that point. And so she identified it and said, yes, I think this is appealable. And even if you take the court, her saying, well, I determined later that, you know, it wasn't appealable because it was in a final order. In the context of this case, which was a multi-nation, she got emergency relief in Fairfax without any notice to the court in Fairfax, without any notice to my client. She went to Nepal and started proceeding. During that time frame, she says, I'm going to note an appeal. And what that does in Fairfax, as we know, is it stops the proceedings in Fairfax. And it really opens a door for her in Nepal. And Your Honor, I would say, even if you say that doesn't bar it, I think it's very much evidence of unclean hands. You say on October 17th, I've decided I'm not going to appeal this, I'm not going to pursue this appeal, and you do nothing about it until February. And I think in the context of this case, I want to bring that to the court's attention.
Well, let me interrupt you, because I'm looking at our enabling statute, our jurisdictional statute for the Court of Appeals, and I think Judge McCullough's point, while it's sort of an abstract one, I guess, in this instance, it's a good one, though. Because our appellate jurisdiction relating to this sort of thing flows from a final judgment order or decree of a circuit court involving either affirmance or annulment of a marriage, divorce, custody, or spousal and child support. So in terms of disposition of marital property, if there's no divorce involved, I don't think I suggest that the statute doesn't give us authority to distribute property in the absence of a divorce.
Well, then I would say it's bad faith to file an appeal at that point and stay the proceedings.
Well, right, and I'm not saying I embrace that, and as a litigation tactic, that's what we should endorse. I'm just looking at an appeal to this court that we would have had no jurisdiction to adjudicate, that was then withdrawn as having some kind of a preclusive effect.
Well, I think it probably, Your Honor, is arguable, but I think What does preclude this court's jurisdiction is the lack of preservation of appeal. And I don't think the arguments that Your Honor pointed to, her written arguments, could possibly have preserved an appeal in this case, because there was a finding, a factual finding by the judge of unclean hands. And he sets forth very specifically the things that he believes provides that there's unclean hands. That didn't happen until after that pleading was filed. She didn't object at the time. She didn't object in the order. She vaguely objected on the final decree. And so the point of Rule 5.18 is to bring to the trial court's attention if there's any error, they can address it. And certainly none of this was brought to the trial court's attention. And she can't say she preserved an issue for appeal before it was ever determined by the court. Nothing, no objection ever occurred after that finding. And Your Honor, I hear the ends of the justice. You've heard it several times already today. I mean, it's liberally argued and very narrowly construed. She argued she didn't get an equitable distribution in that, and therefore ends of justice should apply. She absolutely got that equitable distribution.
Well, I'm reasonably certain there's no cases since the merger of law and equity, but if I'm remembering correctly what I learned some 40 years ago in law school about equity, if there's a finding of unclean hands that's supported by the record, you're not entitled to any equitable relief at all, period.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think on her, the court found independently that despite anything else, she was barred from moving forward on unclean hands. And because that's an independent finding and it's not appealed, I don't believe this is properly before the court. But I won't go into the ends of justice because I think...
So let me just make sure I understand your argument. Her counter-argument to what I brought up regarding the vagueness of the seen and objected to as contrary to the law and the evidence was, well, she stated all these various grounds for the court providing or not providing comedy to this Nepalese order. Your counter-argument to that was, but no objection was ever made to the unclean hands finding by the trial court. Do I understand correctly that that's your argument?
That is my argument, Your Honor. And just to be perfectly clear on that, she couldn't have stated an objection prior to the hearing because the finding didn't happen until the hearing. And so I think the court has already pointed out, and it's clear, she didn't make any objection that would preserve a record, an issue for appeal after the hearing.
Okay, I understand the argument.
So I think it's also very important to work on, explain some of the factual information here. The court knows that, I mean, Mike.
I know you want to get to that. There's something I'd like you to help me resolve. There's this argument, forget the pension, I understand that argument. But there's an argument that in addition to these schedules that were submitted in Nepal,
mm-hmm.
that there's additional property like cars or bank accounts that the Nepalese court never adjudicated, and it's just floating out there. And so it's a loose end that we need to tie up.
I think I can tie that up for you very easily, Your Honor, and I'm glad you actually asked about it. All of the information was submitted. Everything the parties owned was submitted in the equitable distribution chart. And I know in her footnote she argues that that wasn't properly before the court. Your Honor, the trial court actually said, and I quote him, it was perfectly permissible to present that chart. And that's on Appendix 658. And then...
And that finding is supported by the record because the expert said whatever was in those schedules would have been adjudicated by the Nepalese court, notwithstanding the fact that you can't find it in the order, but the court accepted that testimony.
But I think it is in the order. I'm gonna give you more evidence
okay.
than that,
right.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
I think that it is absolutely in the order. And so the accounts that she argues were not addressed, well, the Bank Fund Federal Credit Union account was addressed on page 776. The Capital One accounts were divided upon 776 also. And the jewelry was divided on 775. Now, on 774, this is confusing because, you know, we're not all familiar with Nepalese law. What the court says is that, you know, pursuant to the women's share and property section of the Nepalese code, you know, she keeps her property. Well, if you look on the equitable distribution chart, the only thing they didn't distribute were things that were in her name. Because under the law in Nepal, she keeps everything under her name.
The bottom line is there are no loose ends.
There are no loose ends, Your Honor. There are no loose ends. She doesn't like what happened with the pension. She picked the forum. She kept her pension. He kept his pension. And so I think that is one thing that this court has to understand. Everything was addressed. You know, our expert testified that everything was addressed, but beyond that, what was addressed is absolutely in the order.
In effect, a Virginia court might incorporate something by reference and say, hey, here's that schedule, that's where that goes, without having within the order a detailed recitation of the property.
Right, what happens is the accounts, they say this is how this, the funds held in the Bank of America account, they go to her. The funds in the Capital One account, they're gonna be divided this way. It doesn't specify each single thing, but it's not required to do that. But there are no loose ends in this case, Your Honor. Everything is very clearly detailed. And to the extent that, you know, she relies on the statement that's saying that somehow my client provided false evidence, there's nothing in the record that demonstrates, in fact, what the expert testimony was.
And that was litigated to finality in the call anyway.
Yes, it was, Your Honor. She, you know, she had, in terms of the waste or dissipation of marital assets, she brought three separate law school suits in Nepal on that. She's very adept at using the Nepalese legal system. And she
may not get the results she wants, but she...
That's right. But she brought the cases. She brought in 14 witnesses on those cases. And she really misstates some things that are important factually for this court to understand. None of the loans were paid back after the Penn and Eliti order. And the loan documents themselves are very clear about that. On page 571, 574, and 577, what the loan documents say is between 1997 and 2009, the parties took loans from his family. And the December 23rd, 2011 documents say how those were paid back, I mean, with specificity. Here's the check number, as you would have to do if you were in a divorce situation. You wouldn't do that necessarily if you weren't in a divorce situation. And what's really interesting in this case is the wife acknowledges this is how the family did it. She acknowledges that she gave and received money for family members, and she wouldn't expect that there would be documents because this is how their culture did it. And that's on 826 and 827 in her deposition. But looking at the documents themselves, they show that the loans were paid back before the Penn and Eliti order was entered. The spousal support issue, Your Honor, she chose the forum. She made an election. I think that the athlete's expert was very clear what Nepalese law was. You have to make an election at your choice, at the wife's choice. She chose a property distribution. Now, I think what's interesting is she now gets up here and says, well, the law is different. The only way she'd have gotten that inherited property was if she went to Nepal. Well, she can't now complain. She got his inherited property. She got his gifted property.
I mean, as I read this record, Nepal is in some ways broader in the way it sweeps in property.
Yes.
In some ways narrower, but that was the choice that was made.
It's very interesting. It's a choice that she made after already accessing the Fairfax Circuit Court. So it's very disingenuous to come here now and say, well, what I'm asking for is another bite at the apple, quite frankly.
And maybe she didn't initially understand that, but she was represented by counsel in both courts, and so...
I would disagree that she didn't understand it. In her deposition...
I'm just hypothetically saying, even if that's not the case, when you're represented by counsel can disabuse you of your ignorance of the law.
In her deposition, she acknowledged that she knew the law was different, and she knew the law was different when she chose to pursue it in Nepal. Unclean hands may not be used all that often, but I think this case...
Well, we've said repeatedly it's not to be used at all in equitable distribution.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that in this case it is appropriate because it's stopping her from getting a second bite at this particular apple. But in conclusion, and having just heard this case, and I know it's not really International Day, but it felt like it a little bit, you know, the Supreme Court has noted that, you know, it's as important to have a place to end a divorce as it is to begin a divorce. And, you know, divorce issues are vitally important. And they have to come to an end. And I would ask this court to take into consideration what the Supreme Court has said and understand that the legal process needs to end. She chose the forum here. She got relief. She can't come now and collaterally attack it. And I appreciate the opportunity to be heard today.
Okay. 1 minute.
I'll make this brief, Your Honor. I would just like to clarify that the initial notice that I sent to the Court of Appeals, as stated on an appendix page 979, I informed them on December 27th, so it wasn't in February. It was in December, and not too untimely. I would also like to point out that the May 7th property distribution order from the Nepal Court, as stated on page 776 of the appendix, states exactly, it lists exactly all of the property that was distributed. I don't see cars anywhere. I don't see all of the bank accounts that appellee listed in her addendum. To say that it was incorporated by reference would be one thing, but it doesn't state that in the order. So how is my client supposed to know that those items were in fact distributed between the parties? And to the extent that the aspect of the property that wasn't distributed between the parties was the jurisdiction was specifically retained by the Virginia courts, is something that I think cannot be overstated and is very important to my client. Also, I would just like to state that when the Virginia courts and the Court of Appeals has held in McFarland and Clark v. Clark and Oil v. Oil, that a Virginia citizen, which she is a Virginia resident, is entitled to the protection of and should be afforded all of the rights established under Virginia law. Now, a lot has been made that she went over there and she chose the form and doesn't like the outcome, and so now she's trying to get a second bite at the apple. But when we're talking about applying the principle of comedy, we have to look at whether the two systems are similar enough that you should grant comedy to the decree of another foreign country. And clearly, I think it's been stated already that you either, for one example, you either get spousal support in the form of property, or you get spousal support as a form of support. And here in Virginia, you'd be entitled to both. Over there, you get one or the other. Also,
we're well past the minute mark.
I'm sorry.
And we have the benefit of your well-written brief to guide us through your
I appreciate your time.
We'll come down to Greek Council and the court will be adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.